It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Governor Walker announced a new proposal last week to begin performance-based funding at the UW system. We'll take a closer look. First, it's Labor Day in the United States. People are cooking out, getting ready to head back to school and relaxing on the unofficial end of summer. But while Labor Day today can feel like it's about the beginning of fall, its origins in the United States tell a different story. Historian Kenneth Davis joins us now to fill us in. He's the author of Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
It is a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me, and happy Labor Day, I suppose. Some of us are working, though.
Some of us are working, and it's an interesting callback, though, to the origins of Labor Day and how it got its start in the United States. Tell us about those the very first Labor Day. How did it happen?
Well, it actually was on this date, September 5th, in New York City, in America at least, in 1882. Unions decided to call for a day off. This was a pretty radical thing to do at the time, and they wanted a day off not to just have a picnic, but to really have a chance to organize, protest in favor of some of the things that they were working for in those days, and that means the end of what were horrific conditions, 12-hour work days, 6-day weeks, certainly no benefits, no unemployment. Child labor was commonplace throughout the United States of America, and children did often the most dangerous and dirty work because they were small. They could get into the crevices of coal mines or get into the backs of looms in big factories. So it was really a nightmarish time to be a working man or woman or child in America. And that began a long and violent period of labor unrest in America, highlighted by a number of very serious and sometimes deadly riots. Haymarket Square in Chicago, the Homestead Riot, the Pullman Strike. And it was after that last one, the Pullman Strike, which was in the 1890s, that Grover Cleveland, the president, thought he'd just kind of throw a sop to the working man and create a holiday on the first Monday in September. And that's why we celebrate Labor Day where we do.
And so Grover Cleveland signed Labor Day into law. What did that mean for labor rights? Did that mean it was a done deal, these things that workers were looking for that you described? Or how much more work was there after that?
Far, far from it. And, of course, the path to a national Labor Day holiday. And the September date is important, by the way, because it was initially chosen by the union organizers in 1882 as a day midway between the 4th of July and Thanksgiving Day, about the only other holidays that most working people could expect to get in those days. And that didn't even mean a paid holiday. It just means that the factories were closed. But in the meantime had come the Haymarket Square riot in 1884, 2 years later, and that happened in May. And while many countries around the world have adopted May Day as the International Workers' Day of Solidarity in honor of the martyrs of Haymarket Square, the union leaders who were unjustly and incorrectly executed for their part in this deadly riot, the United States decided we'll put Labor Day in September and keep it far away from any recognition of the martyrs of Haymarket Square.
Is that to avoid any kind of political unrest that might be associated with that day?
That's right. They didn't want, and the unions were rather content to go along with that. They didn't want this to become a kind of radicalized recognition of a day of death and destruction, but rather a day to celebrate the spirit of the working man, as they would have put it back then. The problem is, of course, that it was a holiday, but none of the things that most union organizers were struggling for, and the struggle was very, very violent, and usually the companies had the full participation and full cooperation of the federal government as well as state and local governments in suppressing strikes, continued for a long time. It's not until the 1930s during the Great Depression that most of the things that unions were fighting for came to pass as in terms of federal labor laws, like an eight-hour day and an end to child labor. So this was a long and bitter civil war in America in the long period after the American Civil War in the sense of North and South. But this was a war between business and working people, and the businesses usually had the complete compliance of the government in putting down these strikes. As I mentioned, Grover Cleveland had suppressed a strike of the Pullman Car Company, one of the country's largest manufacturers at the time. Cleveland sent 12,000 federal troops the Chicago area to break the strike on the premise that the strike interfered with the U.S. mail, which was a bit of a stretch.
Right, and you had mentioned that that he signed Labor Day into law to maybe quell any sort of political upheaval about that. Did it work at the time?
Well, it was also, I think we would call it today a kind of a bone toss to the labor movement, and Cleveland certainly hoped it would help with his reelection campaign, and in that it was not successful. The working men, who were the only ones who could vote, obviously, at the time, had a long enough memory that they didn't particularly care for Grover Cleveland's simply giving them a day off. They wanted the things that they were really trying to do at the time, and organizing and getting those basic fundamental rights, including a decent living wage, were what the unions were fighting for at the time. And I think it's important that we look back at this and remember, and we enjoy it as a holiday of the last fling of summertime, but it really is this moment that's born in tremendous blood, sweat, and tears, and it's a moment that's largely forgotten and overlooked, and the whole relationship of labor and business these days is a serious issue, and certainly one that's not being discussed in the campaign.
We're talking right now with Kenneth Davis about the history of Labor Day. He's a historian and the author of Don't Know Much About History. And Ken, how has Labor Day and the way we celebrate it, the way we perceive it and remember it, how has that changed over time?
Well, certainly in the early days of the Labor Day movement in the early 20th century, right up until into the 1950s and 60s, this was much more of a union organizing day. And being in New York City, where I am, and I'm speaking to you from New York, where the first Labor Day in America was celebrated, as I mentioned, in 1882, it used to be a big union day, and there were major union parades to express that solidarity and continue organizing and fighting for the union's aims. You know, by the end of the 60s and certainly going into the 70s, the country changed a great deal in terms of its attitudes about unionism. I think unions, trade unions, were the victims of their own success in some respects. They were also troubled, of course, by the charges of corruption in unions like the Teamsters in particular. So union membership, which was very strong up and through up until the 1950s and 60s, started to fade. I believe it's down to around 12 million union members today. The largest single union is still the teachers' union.
Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing the history of Labor Day. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, and I do hope that some of the candidates start to talk about these issues because they're important ones.
Ken, thanks for joining us. Ken Davis, historian and the author of Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learn. And he was with us today to talk about the history of Labor Day in the United States and also a look there at how it changed over the years. Coming up, we'll talk to a reporter about Governor Walker's proposal to fund the UW system based on performance. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we look at issues of work and rest in a 24-hour world. But first, funding for the UW system has been contentious. It's the last state budget cycle with $250 million in cuts to the UW system. Now Governor Walker announced plans to give new funding to the UW system schools based on performance. There have been mixed responses to that proposal and how effective it might be. Nico Savage joins us now. He's the higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and he wrote a piece looking at reactions to Governor Walker's plans and the effectiveness of performance-based funding. Nico, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with our definition. What is performance-based funding? It's also called outcomes-based funding.
Right. So this is the idea that you tie the amount of money that a higher education system gets to how it does in certain categories. Now, these vary by state and they vary by college, but some of the ones that we've seen are things like the number of graduates that a college produces, the graduation rate, the number of graduates who are placed in a certain field or who have degrees in certain high-demand fields. Basically, it's tying your funding not just to, you know, what you got in the last budget cycle, which is how universities and many state agencies are generally funded, but more to how those universities perform in certain categories.
So there's that aspect of it, and I understand it also has the potential to change the relationship between the university system and the state legislature, which has been troubled lately.
Right.
What did you find out about how that could change?
Sure. This is a point that's brought up by proponents of performance-based funding, which is that essentially it forges better relationships by getting state officials, state politicians, and university officials to kind of sit down and agree on what constitutes their universities being effective. You know, a complaint that you often hear from politicians is that universities aren't responding to the needs of the state, that they're not being held accountable. And you'll often also hear from university officials that, well, what does accountability mean? We think we're being accountable by doing this. An argument from proponents of performance-based funding is that it basically sets the rules. It says, you know, this is what it means to be accountable. This is what it means to meet the needs of the state. And this gets people to kind of be on the same page when it comes to what they're talking about.
How widespread is this kind of funding elsewhere in the country?
Very widespread. There's over 30 states that have it, including here in Wisconsin. So Wisconsin's technical college system receives, at this point, about 30% of its funding, or distributes about 30% of its funding, based on how technical colleges perform in a group of nine categories. This would be the first time that we've seen it for the University of Wisconsin system, but it's in place, you know, elsewhere in Tennessee. Almost all of their higher education funding is based on performance, and there's a big variety in how these performance-based funding models have been rolled out across the country.
And is it applied equally, as far as you know, in states that have that don't have Republican-controlled legislatures? Is it something that's not a partisan sort of issue?
To an extent, it has been more popular among Republican politicians, according to some research from a UW-Madison professor, Nick Hillman, more popular among Republicans. But you've also seen in Tennessee, it was a Democrat a Democratic governor who put higher performance-based funding in place. So it's not a directly partisan issue, but you've definitely seen more of a push to embrace it among Republicans.
Now, UW system funding was cut pretty severely in the last budget cycle. What has
Right.
the governor said about how using this new outcomes-based funding system could change the way UW gets funded next time around in the next budget cycle?
Right. The governor has said he wants to include new performance-based funding for the university. That would reverse a trend, as you mentioned, that we've seen over the past several budgets of UW seeing its funding cut. It's been cut in five of the last six state budgets, most recently by $250 million over 2 years in the last budget. And university officials and backers of the university have been saying that you can't afford to keep cutting the university system and have it maintain its quality. If there is indeed new performance-based funding for the system, that would be a fairly substantial change over what we've seen recently. The question is going to be, as it you know, always is in these sorts of situations. How much new funding is it going to be? And what are the rules? You know, what are the performance criteria going to be? How are you measuring UW's performance, and how might that impact things?
Has Governor Walker said what he'd like those rules and criteria to be so far?
He's given some indication. There was a release that he did, his weekly radio address, where he mentioned, you know, basing it perhaps on the number of graduates who find jobs after they graduate, job placement. That's a popular one. That was one of the categories that he's mentioned. But there haven't been too many specifics so far as you know, what this would be based on, and again, how much money would be on the table here.
And if this performance-based evaluation again goes through, would the UW system and various officials get the chance to weigh in on these goals?
They say that that so far, according to UW officials, the governor's office is open to collaborating with them. They want to be a part of this process. They don't want it to be something that is kind of prescripted. So it sounds like they're probably going to have a seat at the table, which proponents of performance-based funding say is very important. You need to have you can't just kind of bring this system down from on high, they said. There's got to be some work between the university and the state as far as setting that up.
And have UW officials made an official statement about their response to this suggestion of beginning performance-based funding?
Sure, yeah. One of the things that they say is that, first of all, they want to work with the governor, they want to work with the legislature on that. They also say that they track a lot of the data that folks have indicated they want to see in this, things like graduation rates, things like you know, the number of dual enrollment credits or time to degree. I mean, what UW says is, listen, we've got this data already. We're tracking it. We're happy to share it to show what we're doing.
We're talking with Nico Savage right now, higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and we're talking about Governor Walker's plans to begin performance-based funding at the UW system. And Nico, you know, as you begin something new like this, the question is, does it work? Is it effective? Does it help students and the university itself? And you got a couple of different perspectives on this. You began talking with UW professor Nicholas Hillman about his work. He studied this. What did he find?
Right. Professor Hillman reviewed 12 different studies that compared states with performance-based funding and those that use kind of more conventional models. And his research basically found that performance-based funding didn't make much of a difference. It said it showed little or no improvement in the graduation rates or the number of degrees awarded in states with performance-based funding compared to those that didn't. And he argues that this basically shows that, you know, performance-based funding doesn't quite live up to its promise to make universities more effective or more responsive to student needs. And what he says is that, you know, this is in part because getting a student to graduate college is not, you know, as simple as, you know, processing a form quicker or something like that. It's not something where just one person is involved. This is, you know, we're talking about advisors, professors, and all these different factors that go into whether or not a student graduates from college. And he says that, you know, it's hard, even if you put an incentive there, which is what performance-based funding is, it's hard to necessarily change that when you have so many moving parts. Now, proponents of the funding model say that it's too soon to judge a lot of the performance-based funding initiatives that we've seen. I mentioned Tennessee as a state that has nearly all of its funding coming based on performance, and what proponents say is that, you know, even that state has only had that for a few years. And if we're going to talk about graduation rates, and it takes folks 3-4 years to graduate, you know, it's going to be a while until you start to see a turnaround in those numbers. So they say it's too soon to judge the data on whether or not this works.
Now, Professor Hillman at UW, in his study, he said that there could be unintended consequences that could unfavorably affect people of color, students of color, for instance.
Right.
What did he say about some of those things?
Right. Essentially, the concern that Professor Hillman raises is that performance-based funding could exacerbate inequality within higher education. So a couple of things. First, when colleges are judged on their graduation rates, he says, they might get a little more risk averse, and in the eyes of college admissions officers, that could mean extending admissions offers to fewer minority and low-income students if they think that those students are less likely to graduate. That in turn could make institutions less diverse. He also said that the schools that have tended to benefit most under performance-based budget models, they're often those institutions that already have a lot of resources and also tend to cater to what more well-off students. Less well-off colleges, those that don't have big endowments and that often tend to serve minority students and low-income students, they don't tend to measure up as well in those funding models, and they don't tend to see as much of the benefit of new funding.
And did proponents of performance-based funding models, did they respond to those particular concerns?
Yeah, and they say that the way that you address those issues is to essentially design your performance-based funding system well. You want to make sure that you, for instance, give colleges incentives to reach out to whether it's underrepresented minority students or low-income students or students who are veterans or who are disabled. You want to give them incentives to reach out to those students to avoid those negative consequences. For instance, in the University of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Technical College system, one of the measures is the percentage of students who are from groups such as racial minorities, veterans, disabled students, low-income students, that sort of thing.
And this is a measure that Governor Walker is calling for in the next budget cycle. So what are the next steps here?
The next steps are going to be waiting to find out what's in the budget that the governor is going to propose. We'll find that out early next year. We're going to see the kind of full budget proposal. So it'll be a question, first of all, of what's in the governor's budget and then what the state legislature wants to include. And we'll be doing a lot of that next year.
Nico, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Nico Savage, higher education reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about reactions to Governor Walker's call for outcomes-based funding at the UW system. Coming up after the news, we'll find out why new data shows a flexible schedule isn't a license to slack off. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Wisconsin appears to have a low infant mortality rate overall, but a guest tells us there are racial disparities in infant health that might be overlooked. First, clocking in long hours at the office and being available 24 hours a day are getting to be the norm in a round-the-clock working world. That is, if you only have one job, many Americans are working two or even three jobs to make ends meet and trying to be on call for all of them. So with all the time on the job, what happens to leisure time and to rest? And what works for employees and employers when it comes to productivity? Bridget Schulte is a longtime journalist and the author of the book Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. She's now the director of the Better Life Lab at New America. Bridget, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, it's so great to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, what trends are you seeing now when it comes to how much people are working?
Well, there's a couple things that I think are really important for everybody to kind of follow. And one of them is really that work is changing. The nature of work, the way we work is changing for office workers, but also for, for hourly workers. And I think that that's part of what fuels a lot of this long work hour culture that we have. And, for office workers, there's this sense that work, how do you know when you're done? You're not making widgets at a factory. So there's that sense that with technology that you're always on, that you can never finish. You're never sort of done. And for hourly workers, the nature of our families and how we work has totally changed. I was thinking, here it is on Labor Day. I just got back from Target, where I was with my daughter doing school shopping. And, 40, 50 years ago, all the stores would have been closed today. It's a holiday. But because right now we have a majority of men and women who work, we don't have the at-home caregiver anymore who could go school shopping on a Tuesday or a Wednesday afternoon. many of our shops now are open late nights, weekends, and evenings, and then you have to have the people who work in those places. And so for lower wage workers or retail workers, they're working erratic hours kind of all the time. So it's really the nature of work that's really changed. That's part of what's kind of driving this sense of always being on for really all workers.
So what is driving the change that you're describing there? I mean, can we point the finger at technology, or are there even bigger forces at work?
That was a really good question. I think we all assume that it's technology, and technology, certainly this layer of technology, affects all workers. You know, for office workers, it's really interesting. In the United States, we're the only advanced economy with no vacation, national vacation, paid vacation policy. A lot of us don't take vacation, or if we do, we take work along. And then there have been a number of surveys, and the number one reason why people either don't go on vacation or take work along with them is that they're terrified of their email inbox when they get back, that it's just going to be overflowing. So here is this technology that was supposed to make life easier and better, actually making life more complicated. So that's one way technology has really impacted office workers and knowledge workers. And then for retail workers, you know, technology is, you know, they use just-in-time scheduling, and they've got all these really elaborate different scheduling systems. And when you don't really realize that there are people on the other end of those schedules and they're not just widgets to kind of play around in different time slots, that can make life really complicated for those workers, especially if you don't have a lot of notice and all of a sudden you're working a certain shift one day and then a completely different shift the next. It's very difficult to plan your life or to set up childcare or whatever you might need. So technology certainly is affecting all of us. I would say one of the things that some of the most recent research is showing is that work has become so much more complicated. That's with meetings and with technology. There was a really fascinating work done by McKinsey Global, a consulting company. And they found that for the traditional office worker, about 28% of your work week, so nearly a third of your work week, is filled with just dealing with email.
A third.
That is a lot of time that you're not really doing. You know, a lot of us, email is sort of integrated in what we do, but a lot of times it's not. So work has become really complicated in ways that pull us away and distract us from doing sort of the heart of the work, which then makes the work hours kind of creep longer and longer and into our lives.
And Bridget, you mentioned the word fear before. You said people are afraid that they're going to come back and be confronted with a monumental email inbox. But is there also still that lingering fear that people had? It was reported on during the Great Recession, where people were afraid if they weren't in the office, you know, 9, 10, 11 hours a day, that they were going to be the one to get the axe when the belt got tightened. Is there still that, or is it something different now?
Well, I think that there's no doubt there was a number of surveys that really showed that there are sort of anecdotal evidence as well from interviews with workers that there was this feeling during the Great Recession when a number of firms were cutting back and more people, workers, were having to do more with less, that work hours naturally were sort of extending for people. And then that never changed. It's not like once firms got on their feet, they began hiring again to the same level that they had. So the Great Recession really did restructure work. So workloads got heavier and they've stayed heavier. That's absolutely true. And then there, you know, in the United States, we've got this culture that really values and rewards long work hours, like you had mentioned. You know, for instance, a lot of people think that, you know, in the United States, we work really, you know, compared to global averages, we work really long hours. And we work more extreme hours than many other advanced economies, you know, people working over 50 and 60-hour work weeks. And some of that is very much fear-based from the Great Recession, that feeling like if I'm not in the office, then I'm not going to be seen as committed and I'm going to get the axe. So part of it is fear, but part of it is also trying to show that you're committed, to get ahead, to work those long hours, to kind of put in the face time. And the interesting thing about that is a lot of people think that that's related to technology, and yet those work hours started to increase for office workers, professionals, managers, for the knowledge class, knowledge workers, back in the 1980s. And so we've seen a steady rise really since the 1980s, and that was long before we started carrying a smartphone in our pocket.
We're talking with Bridget Schulte right now. She's the director of the Better Life Lab at New America and also the author of the book, Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time, talking about issues of work and leisure and off time in today's world. And Bridget, I know you've been writing about some of the latest developments in the way we perceive work. And one of them is the flexible schedule, which, you know, in this 24-hour world, a lot of people say, well, then maybe I can just have a more flexible schedule and workplaces are trying it out. But then on the flip side, seems like there's this fear going hand in hand with that people will slack off if you give them these, you know, flexible schedules. So what's the latest?
Right. Well, that's the interesting thing, that what you point out is absolutely true. There is this general fear, or this, I would almost say, a prejudice or a bias, that if workers work a flexible schedule, or if they're working remotely, or if they're not in the office, there seems to be this kind of automatic assumption that they're not working as hard or they're slacking off. And that's been a long time assumption. And the truth is, there was a recent research that came out of the UK, actually, that found that people who work those flexible hours, who do remote working or telecommute, they actually put in longer hours than people in the office. They actually work harder. And the other thing that's interesting about that is that's not a new finding. There was actually studies done way back when telecommuting and remote work just started about a decade ago, studies of IBM workers that found the very same thing. And the interesting thing about that is there's really two ways to look at that. And one is, when you're working flexibly, and on the one hand, you feel happier because you're more in control. You're in a, you're sort of in an environment where you feel like you have, where you want to be, where, you know, if your kids are coming home from school, you're going to be there. If you need to make dinner or run an errand, you can break and do that, so that there is sort of a general, greater satisfaction, even if you're working those longer hours. But I think the second and more important thing to understand is that if you're working flexibly, but you work for a company or a culture that really values face time and values long hours, then you almost see this flexible work as a gift or a privilege, and you're sort of afraid of losing it. And so then you work doubly hard just to show that you've earned it, that you're not slacking off, to try to, you know, fight against that really uncalled for and unproven bias. So it's very interesting. I think that when you look at companies where there is a culture that values what I like to call effective work, which is really defining your mission, setting a reasonable workload, and getting your work done, but then preserving time to go home and do things outside of work and refresh yourself, which frankly actually makes you better at work. In those kinds of cultures, you don't see the same overwork when you have a flexible schedule. So a lot of that overwork from flexibility really is tied back to whatever the culture is in the home office.
Bridget Schulte is with us now. She's the author of the book, Overworked, Work, Life, and Play When No One Has the Time. And we're talking about these issues of work and rest and working schedules and productivity, all of this in our 24-hour work world. And we'd love to hear from you. Are you getting the downtime you need when you're working in this 24-hour world? Do you have one of these flexible schedules? And how is it perceived at your workplace? Does it feel like a gift? Or does it feel like something that's integrated? Maybe, as Bridget was saying, you work in a place that's supportive and is more interested in effective work time. Tell us what makes you the most productive and how you fit your life in around your job. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Bridget Schulte stays with us now. She's the director of the Better Life Lab at New America. And we're talking about these issues of work and rest and productivity, effectiveness in a 24-hour world. And we want to hear from you on this. Is the line for you between your home life and your work life getting blurry? How do you handle that? And what do you think makes the most effective workplace culture when it comes to hours and productivity? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Bridget, I know another thing that you took a look at was the culture of work and, I guess, overwork at nonprofits. What did you find there?
Oh, yeah. Very interesting now that I work at a nonprofit. Well, and this has been something that's fairly well known, you know, sort of anecdotally, but there was a study that also found that if you work at a nonprofit, that long hours tend to be sort of standard, that everybody works long hours. And part of that, a couple of reasons drive that. And part of it is that if you work at a nonprofit, you typically are motivated by something other than money. You're passionate about making change. You're passionate about seeing the world improve or make it a better place. So it's hard to know when your work is done. That's certainly what I'm struggling with right now. Mm. You know, I'm trying to like talk about these issues about how do you redesign work and how do you create a better life for people. And it's, you know, hard to know when the day is done on a Monday or a Tuesday, because these are big life changing issues that people are working on. So it's hard to know when you're done. You know, so you have these, some people call them hero hours that you tend to work. I try not to, although, you know, like anybody, I'll fall into it sometimes. But very interestingly as well, a number of, you know, a certain number of nonprofits, you know, you rely on foundations and funding, and sometimes funding can be tight. And so they rely on a lot of younger workers who will work really, really hard for not a whole lot of money. And it was very interesting that there are new federal overtime laws that they're really trying to make sure that people who do work overtime are compensated for it. And some of the people who were fighting against that were some very progressive nonprofits saying, you know, we don't raise enough money, and if you do this, then we won't be able to do our job. So really kind of in that very interesting bind. I'm happy to say that New America is not in that bind, and also that we really make an effort to value people's time away from work. It is certainly a struggle when you're working on these big kind of life-changing issues, and yet the research is so clear that if you do not make time for rest, deliberate rest, you really, it takes you two and three times as long to do your work. You really will not be as productive. You will not do effective work. But if you really want the best work out of people and to get the most creativity, the most insight, as well as the most productivity, you really need to limit your work hours.
And I guess I should say thank you for talking to us on Labor Day, for working on Labor Day. I appreciate that, Bridget. And let's take our first caller now. We've got Ken on the line in Kewaunee. Ken, hi.
Hi. I just had a comment about, you know, trying to work your personal life in with your work life, basically. I work in the dairy industry. So basically, cows, they don't take off for the holidays. You're milking them right around the clock, and you're working like crazy hours. They can work will somewhat work with you, you know, to get some time off for your family and stuff. We got rotations for night service calls, you know, after hour type thing. But it's just crazy. Like the comment she was just making now about. You're working longer hours for less pay, and it just seems like that's how it is almost everywhere in kind of this rural area, you know? Mm.
Ken, thank you so much for sharing that. I really appreciate it. And Ken's saying, well, for one thing, his industry, it sounds like there's not a lot of wiggle room there, that the cows sort of dictate the schedule and not necessarily the workers or the needs of the people involved. So what do you know, Bridget? Do you know anything in specific about agriculture?
Well, it's interesting. You know, when you talk about agriculture has always required you know, you're very much tied to the seasons, right? And he's saying the cows don't take vacations. They need to be milked. You know, the fields, they need to be plowed and harvested. And, you know, I come from a family of ranchers in Wyoming. And, you know, there are certain, you got to be out there feeding the animals or the consequences are severe. So, you know, those are very different types of jobs and that require, you know, much more, being much more in tune to kind of the seasons and, you know, the needs of livestock or, you know, which is why historically you, you know, and you had family farms, or you'd have, you know, large families, so you had lots of kids who could help you with that labor, that it's always been, you know, labor intensive. And, you know, that's what he's describing. It's also, you're talking about kind of the change in that agriculture sector where there are fewer and fewer family farms. Most agriculture now is done by, you know, larger conglomerates, and there's, you know, sort of changed the nature of work in that industry as well, so that the, you know, the family farms that you do have left, you know, it's not like in the past when there was a big community and you could kind of share the load with your neighbors, or, you know, the communal barn raising. I'm sure some of that still goes on, but even in the agriculture sector, the work there has changed enormously in a way that it's also affected the way that people have to work and work those longer hours.
Ken,
without as much help.
I appreciate your call, Ken. And Bridget, at your new job, director at the Better Life Lab at New America, and your work studying overwork and feeling overwhelmed, what are some founding principles going forward that would make work work for everybody?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, it really comes back to the nature of work. And what do we value? And right now, because work has changed so much, we're still measuring what success is with an old metric. We're still using time. We still reward people who put in long hours without really understanding the neuroscience and the brain research that shows where you get ideas. And that comes from periods of rest. And that comes from not being overworked and burned out. There's just a growing body of research that shows how overwork and burnout actually leads to poorer health outcomes. There was a recent study that was published in The Lancet, the British Medical Journal, that found that people who work over 55 hours a week, they have a 33% higher risk of having a stroke than somebody who works a regular 40-hour work week. You know, they have a 13% higher risk of coronary heart disease. So we're basically working ourselves to death. And at some point, we just really need to stop and say, what is it that we're trying to do here? What is work? How do we define it? How do we do it well? How do we measure it in a way that isn't just time? Because time worked as a measure when you worked in a factory and you had a certain number of widgets that you had to produce in a certain number of hours. And that's just not the way that most of us work anymore. And there's really good research that shows you really reach what researchers call a cliff, that you can work long hours for a short period of time, you know, and believe me, we've all had to do that. There's a report, there's a deadline, there's something going on, you know, and you can work those extended hours, but really for no more than a few, you know, maybe a week or two. And if you continue on at that pace, you reach what they call a cliff. Literally, after working, routinely working 55 hours and more a week, your productivity just drops off a cliff.
And are American workplaces, are they picking up on this notion about rest?
Well, that's the thing. I think that's where it's really important. A lot of what I'm, you know, what we're looking at and what we're really trying to do is get that message out, is that if you want good work and if you want the best work, if you want effective work, you cannot keep expecting people to overwork. And I think it's really more of a cultural thing. The research is really clear and the research is there. And the question is, how do we convince people that that's really the case and really get them to try to work differently? And so we're working on a couple pilot projects, actually, with a couple different companies and corporations to see if we can measure and test and come out with more data. There's, you know, to the growing body of research about why effective work is the best way to go.
And just briefly, what about those flexible schedules we were talking about? Could those be part of the picture?
That absolutely, they do need to be part of the picture. And flexible work, again, tied into a different definition of success, which is not that the best worker is the one that puts in the longest hours, but the best worker, you've defined what the mission is, you've made it clear what those performance metrics are, and you know, and there's clear communication and feedback both ways so that you can decide what that is. And that you work in an environment where you have autonomy, mastery, and a sense of purpose, that's when you're really going to get the best work done.
Bridget, thank you so much for joining us on this Labor Day. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Bridget Schulte. She's a longtime journalist and the author of Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. And she's also the director of the Better Life Lab at New America. And she joined us there on this Labor Day to talk about issues of work and rest in today's 24-hour working world. It doesn't happen often, but once in a while, the worlds of astronomy and rock and roll collide. Here's Queen guitarist and astrophysicist Brian May with some news.
The International Astronomical Union's Minor Planet Center has deemed it their duty and their pleasure to name an asteroid after Freddie. It will be called Asteroid Freddie Mercury, all one word, 17473. And this is to honor Freddie's 70th birthday.
The asteroid named after Freddie Mercury is located in the main asteroid belt, and apparently you need a pretty strong telescope to see it. The IAU said Mercury was given the honor because of his extraordinary voice and also his influence. And also, apparently, it didn't hurt that the asteroid was originally designated as 1991 FM3. Freddie Mercury would have been 70 years old today.
I'm having a good time.